frontier. These are the voyagers of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one but four separate chat rooms. And if you scroll down there on the super chat room, you will find a banner linked to People for People Radio Network. Go over there and say hi to those wonderful folks. And also, don't forget to check out Wolf Spirit Radio as well. So today, what I want to try to do is do a thought experiment so that gets your mind to ticking of possibilities, because what we're looking for in the world of free energy is efficiency. the more efficient you can, the higher the efficiency you can achieve, the closer you would get to what would be classified as free energy, is what I'm trying to say here. So anyway, there's a thing we call heat that's kind of obnoxious, but we really kind of need it a lot because during the winter time it gets really cold and we need heat to cook food and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes heat is not what we want. Like in our engines, our internal combustion engines, they generate a lot of heat that we have to figure out ways to get rid of because some particular materials will actually hold heat longer. It's ironic. There are materials out there, all kinds of materials that it takes a whole lot longer to heat them up because they are not good conductors of heat. But the deal about that is, once they do get hot, they stay hot for a long time. So that'll bring us into a subject called heat batteries, where basically you can actually store heat energy. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? Because if you could actually collect all the heat energy during the summer months of the year and be able to store some of that to get you through at least a portion of the winter portion of the year, that would be something pretty impressive. And so with that said, in conjunction with solar electricity, while you're storing the heat in, like a thermal type storage system, and you're also storing the electrical energy in a battery or capacitor bank. So now you've got two different forms of energy that can actually be stored. And even to a greater extent, using the laws of physics that you know about, when heat rises and cold air falls, and if you heat something up, it will expand. If you cool it down, it will contract. Taking all of these things in conjunction with each other, there's all kinds of different uses for heat that maybe sometimes get overlooked, in heat pump systems, heat exchange systems, heat transfer systems, basically changing hot to cold and vice versa. It's pretty amazing, but you wouldn't think there would be any energy in cold, but there actually is. So with that said, the materials, like, I don't know if you've ever noticed this in your life, but I used to give this example on the Mad Science Show all the time. If you have an old spare tire in the back of a pickup truck during the summertime, and all day long that thing sitting out there in the sun, rubber has a specific heat that takes a lot more energy than, let's say, a metal or something. So it takes a lot longer, maybe even a lot more energy to heat up rubber. But also, it takes, on the opposite side of the spectrum, it takes longer for that material to cool down. Like, you'd think a solid material would probably hold heat better, but a liquid such as water has a specific heat higher than the land you're standing on. So, because it takes more energy to heat the water up, it also takes a lot more time to cool that water back down. These are things that we can actually use and use the physics of and the science that we understand to basically produce and design our own style heat battery systems. I'm going to play a bit of this podcast right here, and it basically talks about heat, temperature, and energy. So I'm just going to play this live across there in case I want to stop it for a second and make a comment on something.
When we think of heat, different images come to mind. We may think of a fire blazing on a cold winter day, or the hot lava erupting from a volcano. We might associate heat with temperature, like the temperature of water from a faucet, or the number of degrees marked by the rising alcohol in a thermometer. And we might think of heat in terms of energy, such as energy from a hot burner that fries an egg, or the enormous energy of the sun, the ultimate source of almost all the energy on Earth. This program is about heat, temperature, and energy. It is about how these three things are related, but also different.
All matter on Earth contains energy. There is energy in the gases of the Earth's atmosphere and the water that forms its oceans. There is energy in the steel and concrete of a bridge, and even in grains of salt. All matter contains energy because of how matter is put together. Matter is made up of much smaller, invisible particles, atoms and molecules. The smallest particle of salt, for example, is a molecule consisting of a single sodium atom linked to a single chloride atom. This is why the chemical name for salt is sodium chloride. In a grain of salt, these molecules are bunched tightly together and hold each other firmly in place, forming a regular pattern. But even in something solid like salt, the molecules are in constant motion, vibrating back and forth. This internal energy, or energy inside matter, is called thermal energy.
Even something as cold as ice has thermal energy. The water molecules that make up ice vibrate somewhat. But the water molecules in a glass of warm water move around many times more rapidly and have much more thermal energy. When you put ice into warm water, the water gives up some of its thermal energy to the ice. The flow of thermal energy from one place to another is called heat. Heat always flows from something warmer to something colder. When heat is added to a substance, its molecules move faster. When heat is taken away, the molecules slow down.
Heat energy can be converted into other forms of energy, and other forms of energy can be converted into heat energy. In a power plant, heat can turn water into steam that turns turbines. The mechanical energy of turbines, in turn, can be converted to electrical energy. And electrical energy can be converted to heat, as when the coils on this electric burner get red hot. Another illustration of how different forms of energy can be converted to heat energy is provided by this pad, which contains special heat-sensitive chemicals that change color. When you put your hand on the pad, it leaves a slight impression caused by the heat in your skin. If you then rub your hands together vigorously, this mechanical energy causes friction that excites the molecules in your skin, making your hands hotter. And if you place a hand on the pad again, it will leave a much brighter impression.
In addition to making their molecules get more excited, adding heat causes most substances to change in other ways. A simple experiment shows how. This metal ball was designed so that it just fits through this ring. But observe what happens when this student heats the ball. Any experiment involving fire should be done under the supervision of a teacher or other adult. After the ball is heated, it no longer fits because the excited molecules in the ball have moved farther apart, causing it to expand. Now look at what happens when she puts the ball into some cold water to cool it off. When most substances lose heat, they contract because their molecules are less excited and move closer together. Builders and engineers have to take into account that steel, concrete, and other building materials expand when heated and contract when they lose heat. Bridges, for example, have expansion joints that give the steel and concrete sections room to expand in the hot summer months. Water is an important exception to how substances expand and contract when heated and cooled. When water freezes and becomes solid ice, it expands rather than contracts because of a special way water molecules and ice bond to each other.
As they become hotter or cooler, gases and most liquids other than water expand and contract much more than solids. The base of this thermometer contains liquid alcohol. When this liquid is heated by putting it into hot water, its molecules become more excited and move farther apart. The alcohol expands and rises up a very thin tube that runs the length of the thermometer. When it is cooled, the alcohol contracts as its molecules become less active. As it contracts, the alcohol falls down the tube. A scale along the tube marks the temperature. Some thermometers use the Celsius scale, which is based on the fact that water always boils and freezes at the same temperatures when the pressure in the atmosphere is the same. At sea level pressure, 100 degrees Celsius marks the boiling point of water. And 0 degrees Celsius marks the temperature at which water freezes. Other thermometers use a different scale. With a Fahrenheit thermometer, the freezing point of water is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And the boiling point is 212 degrees. The numbers of the two scales are different, but the temperatures they mark are the same.
No matter what kind of scale it has, a thermometer measures temperature, not heat. Temperature and heat are different in important ways. Temperature is a measure of how fast the molecules in a substance are, on average, moving. Measure the temperature in a tub of warm water. Then fill a cup with water from the tub and measure the temperature of this water. The two temperatures will be the same. This is because the molecules of water in the cup are moving around, on average, as much as the molecules of water in the tub. But the tub has much more thermal energy because it has many times the number of water molecules as the cup does. Because it has so much more thermal energy, more heat can flow from the water in the tub than the water in the cup. The water in the tub, for instance, could quickly melt a pitcher of ice.
Which do you think has a higher temperature, the flame of a candle or a radiator? Which has more heat? If you wish, you may stop the video now to discuss these questions. Otherwise, the program will resume in 10 seconds.
10 seconds.
The flame of a candle and a radiator show the differences between heat and temperature. The flame has a much higher temperature, but the radiator has much more thermal energy because it has more molecules than the flame. It can give off a great deal more heat, enough heat, in fact, to warm a whole room. While temperature is measured in degrees, heat is measured in units called calories. A calorie is the amount of heat it takes to raise the temperature of 1 gram of water 1 degree Celsius. The value of any kind of fuel can be measured by how much heat it gives off when it is burned. A gram of gasoline gives off about 11,500 calories. A gram of soft coal gives off 6,000 calories. And a gram of oak gives off 4,000 calories.
We saw earlier that heat always flows from something hotter to something colder. There are different ways that this happens. An experiment shows one way that heat is transferred from one place to another. Here, a student puts some wax on the heads of 3 tacks. He then sticks the tacks so that they are spaced evenly apart along a steel rod. A Bunsen burner then heats the end of the rod. In a few minutes, the heat from the burner is transferred from one end of the rod to the other. The wax melts and the tacks fall off, one after the other. But how does this happen? The steel rod is a solid. The molecules that make up the end of the rod vibrate more quickly when heated. But the molecules can't move from one end of the rod to the other.
Pool provides a hint about what happens with the molecules of the rod. When someone makes a shot, energy is transferred from the player's arm to the white cue ball. When the cue ball hits a second ball, it transfers its energy to the other ball. Often, the cue ball hits one ball that in turn transfers energy to still another ball. Something similar happens with the molecules that make up the steel rod. As the molecules at one end are heated, they speed up and vibrate more. These molecules transfer energy to the molecules next to them, which become excited and move more rapidly. These molecules, in turn, excite the molecules next to them, and so on. In this way, heat energy is passed on from molecule to molecule, the whole length of the rod. This type of transfer of heat is called conduction. Conduction occurs when heat energy flows from one molecule to another as they collide.
Different substances do not conduct heat equally well. These spokes are made of different kinds of metal, including copper, aluminum, steel, and iron. Here, a student has attached a tack to the end of each spoke. He then heats the hub so that each spoke gets an equal amount of heat. The experiment shows that the wax melts and the tack falls off the copper spoke before any of the others. The next tack to fall is from the aluminum spoke, because aluminum is a better conductor than any of the other metals except for copper.
In general, metals like copper, aluminum, and steel are all good conductors. Here, heat from the burner is easily conducted by the metal pot to the sauce. However, some other substances like wood are not good conductors. Many pots have wooden handles because wood does not conduct heat well from the pot to one's hand. Poor conductors like wood are known as insulators. Plastic is also an insulator. This plastic cup helps keep tea warm because the heat from the tea doesn't conduct easily through the plastic to the colder air around the cup.
Pause that for a second because I want to get back to specific heat. Rubber takes a lot more energy to get hot, but it takes a lot longer to cool down, just like water, as opposed to the land, because it takes a lot more energy to get water up to temperature. It also takes a lot more to cool down. The same thing with plastic being not a good conductor of heat. When it gets up to a certain temperature, it takes a lot longer to cool down than other materials that would radiate that heat away from themselves any point in time. So, two of the things that are most important to think about in this thought experiment is conductivity of a material and the specific heat of a material. So if you have, let's say you had a copper tubing and you had, let's say, maybe a rubber hose. Well, that rubber hose, you could hold on to that rubber hose and you could heat the other end of that copper, and that heat wouldn't transfer through to the rubber. And so let me back up a little second. It will transfer to the rubber, but it's not a good conductor, so it won't get hot enough for a long period of time until it finally reaches that point when it actually transfers enough heat over there. It will hold that heat. Actually, you can get rubber so hot you can't even touch it, but nonetheless, because rubber is a poor conductor of heat, you can sit there and hold that while you're heating up that copper tube. However, if you're heating that piece of rubber from the other side, let's say like radiant energy from the sun, and that rubber is absorbing the temperature, it's gradually building up heat, and at some point it'll get too hot for you to be able to touch. And so at that point, the heat is going to go from the hottest portion to the coolest portion, which would now be the copper. So it's actually working in reverse. So if you're heating up the rubber using the sunlight, and that heat needs a place to go, and it's going to hold its heat a lot longer, then it will start to transfer that heat down to the coolest path, which is the copper tubing. When the copper tubing and the rubber are actually sitting out there in the sunlight together, the copper tubing is not going to get as hot because of the type of material that it is as the rubber would get, because, you know, like black rubber is going to absorb heat. All black materials absorb heat, so you can get this rubber super hot, so hot to the extent where you can't even touch it anymore, and then that heat energy will actually transfer through to the copper tubing, which is one of the things that I want to get into later about heat exchange systems. But for a moment, I'm going to go ahead and play some more of this right here.
Here's a question to think about or discuss. How do materials that are good insulators cut down on the amount of energy it takes to heat a home? You may stop the video now. Otherwise, the program will resume in 10 seconds.
Here's the 10-second thing again. 7, 6, 5, 4, woohoo! I'm sorry, but I had to play this.
Insulators are used to help conserve heat in houses and save energy. This insulation is made of fiberglass, which conducts heat poorly. In an attic, it helps prevent heat from escaping through the roof. Certain kinds of windows also help conserve heat. This cutaway model shows how some windows have a layer of air between two layers of glass. Air and other gases are poor conductors. The molecules that make up a gas are far apart, making it hard to transfer energy from one molecule to another.
Liquids are also poor conductors because their molecules are farther apart than the molecules that make up a solid. But heat in liquids and gases can be transferred through another process, convection. Convection is the flow of energy that occurs in a gas or liquid. You can see convection in a pot of heated water. As the water gets warmer, it expands in the bottom of the pot, is less dense, and rises. As the warmer water rises, it cools, becomes more dense, and sinks again. Convection heats homes. A radiator, for example, warms the air near it. This air rises because its molecules are farther apart and it is less dense. The warm air cools as it moves through the house. As it cools, it sinks and moves back to the radiator and is warmed again. Convection occurs in the air in the Earth's atmosphere and makes it possible for these hang gliders to fly. As the sun beats down on the land and bare rock, heat is reflected and warms the air above. This warm air rises, providing strong thermals or updrafts that keep the gliders aloft. Heat from the sun also causes huge convection currents in the Earth's atmosphere that are responsible for weather patterns and wind.
The sun is the ultimate source of most of the heat energy on Earth. At its surface, the sun's temperature is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 6,000 degrees Celsius. But separating the sun from Earth are about 93 million miles, or 150 million kilometers, of mostly empty space. In space, there are not enough molecules to transfer heat by conduction. There also are no gases or liquids in space that can transfer heat to the Earth by convection. But there is a third way that heat can flow from one place to another, even through empty space, by radiation. Radiation can pass through space as waves of energy that are similar to waves that transmit radio and television signals. When radiation from the sun hits things on Earth, it excites molecules and makes them vibrate faster, This is what makes one's skin feel warm on a sunny day. The heat felt from a fire is also transferred by means of radiation. In fact, all heated bodies, whether the sun, a fire, a light, or an electric toaster, radiate heat.
An experiment shows that heat from radiation has different effects on different kinds of surfaces. Get two identical cans and wrap black paper around one and white paper around the other. Fill each can to the same height with water. Place a piece of cardboard on top. Then leave both cans in sunlight so that each is equally exposed to the sun. 15 minutes later, come back and measure the temperature of the water inside the white can. Then compare it to the temperature inside the black can. The water inside the black can gets hotter because dark surfaces absorb radiation better than light surfaces. That is why people wear dark clothes in the winter when they want to be warmer, and wear light-colored clothing during the summer when they want to absorb less heat.
In this program, we saw that matter is made up of atoms and molecules. Even in something solid, these molecules are constantly moving. The energy associated with this movement of molecules is called thermal energy. Heat is the movement of this energy from one place to another. Heat always moves from something warmer to something cooler.
We saw that when heat is added to most substances, they expand as their molecules pull farther apart and take up more space. When most substances are cooled, their molecules move closer together, and they contract.
We saw that thermometers measure temperature, but that temperature is not the same thing as heat. The flame of a candle, for example, has a higher temperature than a radiator, but the radiator can give off more heat.
We saw that heat is transferred from one place to another in different ways. Heat can be transferred through conduction when vibrating molecules collide with other molecules and pass on their energy. Some materials, like metal, are good conductors. Things that are poor conductors are called insulators.
Heat can also be transferred in liquids and gases through convection. A liquid or gas expands and rises when it is heated and sinks as it is cooled. Convection currents in the atmosphere are responsible for wind and much of our weather patterns.
Finally, we saw that heat can be transferred, even through empty space, by radiation. And that radiation from the sun is the Earth's most important source of heat.
Alright, so that, I'm pretty sure you probably already had that much of an education as far as heat and energy transfer. So now's where the thought experiment actually comes into play. The, there's a video out there that I also posted a link to in the Super Chat chat room where it says how to heat a swimming pool with an air conditioner. If you understand about the heat and energy transfer and all that kind of stuff, you'd note that when you compress a gas, it gets hot, all right? And when you allow it to expand rapidly, it gets cool. So what in the heating and cooling, HVAC or heat pump systems and stuff like that, they use those physics in order to be able to, you know, transfer energy from a form of heat or cold, one or the other. But imagine this. You're already running your outside air conditioner unit to cool your house anyway. And your air conditioner, in the process of compressing the gas that actually produces the heat transfer system to, get your cool air, then you already got something going on that has to be gotten rid of. So you have a condenser and all this kind of stuff on your air conditioner unit that has to be able to take and cool that doggone gas back down so that it can be circulated through the cold side of your air conditioner. Well, this particular system that these folks basically designed basically made a heat transfer system to circulate that heat from the heated gas into a basically a not a condenser, doggone it, what the heck am I trying to say here? a heat transfer system, basically a tubing that goes down into a tank and makes a spiral around inside the tank and then goes back out and back into your AC system on the hot side of the gas there and recirculates through the system. But basically what it's doing is taking that heat and transferring it through the tubing into the water that is being circulated from your swimming pool back over. So you can heat your cool the inside of your house at the same time while you heat your swimming pool up. And it actually has a regulator system on there that will regulate the temperature, because if you allow this process to go on too long, if you ever seen my video called Redneck Hot Tub, basically I used a coffee pot element to circulate water from the pool through the coffee pot element and transfer that heat energy back into the pool through the pump again. So I was able to, for 120 volts at whatever wattage that particular coffee pot element was, heat my Redneck hot tub up. And the thing about it is, it might took me 4 hours to get it up to temperature, but because of the specific heat quality of water, it takes a lot more energy and a lot more time to heat water up, per whatever volume it is. But it also takes a lot more time for it to cool down as well. So I was able to transfer that heat energy from that element into the water, and about 4 hours later, it'd be up to operating temperature, and you had a nice hot tub to sit in. Any time after that, the longer you kept it, it would continue to put heat energy into that water, and eventually it would get so hot you couldn't even sit in there. You had to shut the element down and let some of that heat transfer its way out into the atmosphere. But keep in mind that when I made that Redneck hot tub, I didn't insulate underneath the tub, I didn't insulate around the tub, and it was open to the open atmosphere over there. So that shows that there was a lot of energy available to be transferred and stored in that water for separate use. So if I really wanted to, I could have used that same energy twice by putting a coffee pot on top of my doggone element there and heating up my coffee while at the same time heating up the pool, transferring that energy to where I wanted it to go. So these particular individuals who made the swimming pool heater using their air conditioner had to pay for whatever energy that they used to cool their house by running the air conditioner. However, took away what would have normally been waste energy and heated their pool up with this thing. So thinking about that, and thinking about how there are systems in your house that if were supplemented would save you on energy cost, imagine your refrigerator has an air compressor in it, and your refrigerator does put off heat. So if you ever go stick your hand inside the refrigerator, it's cool inside the refrigerator. But if you go around to the back and you stick your hand around the back of it, the back of your refrigerator is warm. Sometimes even hot, depending on how long it's been running. But the key about that is there, you could transfer that heat energy with a few modifications to actually take on the back of your refrigerator, tap into that that heat transfer system that is your refrigerator, and run some insulated lines over to circulate that heat in through your hot water tank. So while you're running your refrigerator, it's taking the heat away, which is going to make the compressor work better because it's not going to get near as hot and probably extend the life of that compressor. So now you transferred that heat energy that would have normally been waste energy that actually goes into your house, which in the wintertime is not a bad thing because, you know, you need all the heat you can get inside your house when it's cold outside. However, it transfers that heat energy over there and supplements your water heater system, which if your water heater system falls below a certain temperature, then the regulator will turn the either the gas on to heat it up, or you know, the resistive electric element that normally has to run. But if that temperature continues to stay up there, then you don't have to have that thing coming on all the time. It would only come on when necessary. The temperature got down too low. But that one process would take your refrigerator and your hot water heater and make the two more efficient, so they wouldn't be using near the electricity. Now imagine at the same time you got a freezer as well, so you could make a smart house basically by tapping into all these heat sources and putting them where you wanted them to go. You could actually even use the old style radiator type systems. Let's say for some reason you're generating more heat, waste heat, than you need from different appliances. That energy could also be transferred and stored and so on. And so, that's what I wanted to get to, the specific heat of different materials. While they take a lot longer to heat up, they also, on the reverse, take a lot longer to cool down. And so there's some physics there that we can work with. And the conductivity, the two best conductors of heat as far as metal go, would be copper and aluminum. Also, it's kind of ironic that copper and aluminum are also the two good conductors in electricity as well. So with all this extra knowledge in there, and then adding in something like a Peltier element, which is a thermoelectric device that, when you put electricity into it, it causes one side to get hot and it causes the other side to get cold. And these things can actually be used in reverse. If you heat one side and cool the other side, then it'll actually produce electricity. So taking in consideration everything I've mentioned so far and what the podcast said, can you visualize in your head possibilities of, let's say, I know that rubber has a specific heat higher than, certain types of metal. So I'm not going to try to store heat energy in the metal, even though it's going to take me longer to get that rubber up to temperature. If I get that rubber hot, I know that I can actually hold that heat energy into that rubber a lot longer than I could in the metal. And so, just like a thermos, when you put hot coffee inside of a thermos or cold water inside of another thermos, those two, the cold or the heat, will be insulated from the surrounding air out there that could give a path for that insulation to, or that heat to be able to transfer. So there's actually a insulation in between there, and since the insulation is a poor conductor of heat, it's going to either hold the heat in or hold the cold in, whichever one it is that you want. So we can even store cold to that extent. We've seen, when you get your refrigerator or your freezer to a certain temperature, it's not running constantly because it's at a certain temperature. And if you can keep it at that certain temperature, then the compressor never kicks on. If the compressor never kicks on, then you don't have to use the electricity necessary to run it. But in the event that you do have to run it, you might as well monopolize on the being able to utilize that heat energy that is basically wasted energy, making that system yet even more efficient. So, materials, conductivity of heat, basically making a heat battery. There's a video out here. I'm going to try to see if I can play a piece of this one video right here, because they're using a kind of more like a chemical reaction to do what it is that I'm saying. But let's see if I can get this to play here.
This is a first. Heat batteries that store thermal energy throughout the seasons.
I'm surprised a little bit that it works so well. So we are all very enthusiastic about it.
We are just happened. Then we are officially discharging one of those modules in Miritsburg.
Hey, it's actually working. We did it. That was a beautiful moment.
Developing an efficient and sustainable energy storage is a common challenge for researchers all over the world.
Space heating is the big, what we would say in English, the elephant in the room. It's not been addressed by people, it's not been addressed by governments, and yet it's the one area where we can make the most savings towards reducing the carbon emissions in the European Union.
The European community wants to have an energy-neutral built environment by 2050.
The combination of solar with storage adequate systems might generate energy for during all the year.
Now, a team of researchers from all over Europe have found a way to store summer heat for use in winter.
They prove the technology. They show that it works. It's not only calculations, but it works in the practice.
The Merits technology is based on a chemical reaction between salt hydrates and water using thermochemical storage, so-called TCS.
So actually the heat is transferred from the solar collectors into the system.
Heat batteries, they are able to store heat in a very compact way and almost without losses.
It's pretty revolutionary, so I think this could potentially bring a breakthrough into the way we see storage of energy.
Sí, aquest projecte va començar fa dos anys i mig. Ja vam fer una reunió d'aquest projecte fa un any.
La Universitat de Lleida participa en un projecte europeu per escalfar llars amb energia solar que funcioni com una bateria de cotxe o una pila, és a dir, que es podria fer servir quan fos necessari.
And in the Polish capital, Warsaw, the group, for the first time, succeeded in storing solar heat in these vessels.
By the process of hydration and dehydration of the salt in these modules, you have the possibility to store heat for a complete season.
For the first time, we will see how the field demonstrator is being used in real life.
This breakthrough technology was finally presented in Delft, the Netherlands, during a symposium hosted by the coordinator of the Merits project, TNO.
And I've really had the honor, because that is how I see it, to coordinate a seven framework program, Merits.
And you did an outstanding job, and I want to thank you for the effort that you made.
These eight containers are our long-term heat batteries. The heat is collected in summer. With the solar collectors, which are on top of the building, and this water vessel serves as a central hub for our systems.
The demonstrator unit also contains a small test house to monitor the process in practice, and a control room where all data are coming in.
So, first of all, this is the first time in the world when this size of installation was really built.
I think the biggest challenges of this technology is first of all to become cost effective. Well, we're not there yet, but it should be economically feasible in the long term, and also the energy density.
It is worldwide the biggest installation for seasonal storage with salt hydrates. According to project coordinator Christoph Huchartz, heat batteries are an important step towards energy neutral buildings. And a great promise for Europe.
What really makes me enthusiastic is that we see that it works, and for the first time, we've...
Yeah, I'll pause that just for a second. I don't know what else is on the podcast, but when he's talking about basically buildings becoming heat or energy neutral buildings or whatever, what that brings to my mind in this thought experiment is that if you've ever been on top of a roof and you see like the composite shingles that are up there that are kind of like made out of asphalt or rubber tar mixed or whatever, the standard shingles, not the ones that you would have wood shakes or even metal roofs. I guess to some extent, depending on what color are they, metal would be a good transfer of heat. But you could also recapture, and that's another one of the videos that I posted down there, heat recovery systems. And so basically, while during the summertime, you could use the roof of your house to store energy. If you've ever been up in the attic, you'll note that during the summertime, it's got vents that go out the other side over there. Plus, a lot of buildings have those little kind of squirrel cage turbines at the top that when the heat rises, using knowledge that heat rises and cold air falls, that turbine will be spinning even when it's not windy outside. That's because it's getting so hot in your attic that heat is rising, escaping out of the roof and keeping that turbine going, which is actually helping to assist pull that heat energy out of the attic, so to speak. So just by the way that you design your house, you can actually make this house so incredibly energy efficient by understanding the physics of the basic science of how energy, how heat and energy work together, how cool air falls. So that would mean you'd want to put your air conditioning in the ceiling, whereas heat rises and you put your heating ducts in the floor, so that you get greater efficiency as that heat is rising up from the floor up to the ceiling. If you ever seen a building that had both the heating and the air conditioning in the ceiling, like most manufactured or even modular home styles, so to save space or whatever, for some reason they thought it would be a good idea to put the heating and cooling into the ceiling itself instead of having the old floor ventilation instead circulating vents or whatever. So during the summertime, your building would be more efficient than it would be during the winter time because of that deal. And so knowing all the different specific heat qualities of any given material will tell you whether or not it's a good material to store heat energy in. Like if you get up on a roof with composition shingles, regular asphalt style shingles, during the summertime, you don't even have to get up on the roof. You can actually see the convection, the heat, the little waves going up off of that thing. You can transfer that heat energy to a storage tank during the wintertime and actually be able to hold it over, or during the summertime and actually be able to hold it over during the wintertime. So think about that and all the ways to transfer that heat energy to where you want it to go. And also Peltier elements, whereas they may not be as efficient as a solar panel, Peltier elements are pretty amazing things. Imagine you got a little Peltier element and you got maybe, let's say, quarter inch or even a half inch thick block of rubber that is about the same size as that Peltier element, and then on the opposite side you have a aluminum heat sink or something like that, something to make a temperature difference. As long as there's a temperature difference, that Peltier element will produce some electricity. So you got this Peltier element with a block of rubber on the top of it and a heat sink on the opposite side, and you set that out in the sunlight. And then while that's out there and it finally gets heated up from all the energy, radiant energy from the sun or whatever, that now you basically produce the heat battery. So you can pick that thing up if you can hold it without burning your fingers. You can get you some leather gloves or something that has a insulation quality so you can pick it up, some oven mitts or something like that. But you could pick that that Peltier element with the block of rubber on one side and the aluminum on the other side, and you can carry that around and transfer that heat energy, you know, inside your house or whatever. And until that rubber was able to transfer that heat energy out of itself and get back to its normal temperature or insulated quality or whatever, that it would basically be a battery. So there's tons and tons of old car tires that exist in this world. You know, you could actually do an experiment for yourself by putting, you know, Peltier elements on one side of the tire and, you know, keeping something cool on in the inside. But that heat would transfer, while that tire is sitting out in the sunlight, that heat would transfer through that Peltier element, and the temperature difference would actually produce the Seebeck effect that actually causes the electricity come out the other side. And then knowing the differences in different types of materials for thermoelectric, like iron and aluminum are really good together as far as being able to get thermoelectrics. So if you got two pieces of wire, one iron and one piece of aluminum, and they're twisted together at the end, and you put heat to that, as long as there's a temperature difference between those two materials, then you will actually get the Seebeck effect, which will produce an electrical charge. Now, the only time that process stops is when both of those materials get to the same exact temperature. There always has to be a temperature difference in order to be able to keep that Seebeck effect going. So knowing all that and the different, specific heat qualities of different types of materials, now you can begin to start thinking of ways that you could actually produce thermoelectrics, and even using things that already, you know, already have, wasted energy to be able to recover the heat losses in the form of energy and move that energy around. So essentially what I've been trying to share with people is that if you ever want to get to the part where when I'm saying that energy's free, which it is, because everything out there has energy in it. There's nothing in there that isn't energy. Most of anything carbon-based could be used as fuel. And different types of materials, like I said, have different types of different specific heat qualities, so that, you know, they will either, you know, heat up fast and cool down fast, or they will heat up slow and cool down slow. That's a really good note to write down on your sticky notes there for, you know, future research. And, you know, being able to store heat energy using that same knowledge. Like if you have a piece of rubber and you get that thing really hot and you drop it down into the thermos, and the thermos has an insulator quality, so these two aren't going to transfer their heat energy easily. It's going to take some time before you can actually get that thing to transfer that energy out of that rubber. That rubber will stay hot for a long, long time. And essentially, that's what they were talking about whenever they talking about this heat battery deal. So let me see. I'm going to see what the rest they had to say on this thing.
Proven this on a very large scale, and I'm confident that we're able to make this this big first step to a sustainable future.
So we'll get rid of that one right there. And now heat storage. Basically, there's, like I said, all kinds of different types of materials that once they get hot, they will stay hot for a long period of time. And I think where did they say that was? Let me see if I can kick this one on for a second.
Wind, rain, and snow.
This is a
times cheaper. This storage will be filled with 10,000 cubic meters of water, but the volume of such storage can be only a few tens of cubic meters or several cubic meters of water. The largest storage in the world has a volume of 203,000 cubic meters of water, and it works with this large solar station with 70,000 square meters of solar collectors. These collectors heat the storage water to 90 degrees Celsius in summer, and this heat is stored until winter. when it will be directed to the district heating system of the Danish town of Vojens.
Okay, that's in a Danish town. Anyway, basically what they did was they used this particular, science, all this different knowledge about different specific heat qualities of different materials and the radiation of the sun to basically, they got a big pool of water, it's like a lake more or less, and underneath it they have these materials that when that heat transfers from the water down in through those materials, they kind of, cause each other to hold heat a lot longer. When they finally get up to operating temperature, this water's pretty doggone hot. And they store this heat energy until it's needed during the cooler portions of time. So, we had mentioned about taking your refrigerator, your air conditioner, and your hot water heater and combining those systems to where you're taking the waste heat off of one to supplement the other to conserve on electricity. So once you get down to understanding all these little simple concepts of science, this thought experiment that I'm talking about, basically, plasma technology that you constantly hear me talking about, where they say that a gas, it's a little harder to heat, but when you compress that gas, and now you get into a different type of technology. There are screw type compressors that is like a positive displacement pump for water. When the gas or the air comes in one side, it starts to compress that air down. And then by the time it gets to the other side, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And by the time it gets to the other side, that air is hot. They use this particular technology in turbos for cars. So you got an automobile that is producing exhaust, and that exhaust pressure is turning a turbine which has a compressor on the opposite side that's bringing cold air in from out side the vehicle and then compressing that air, which causes that air to get hot. And so from that point, you don't want to be pushing hot air down into the intake of the engine, so they put an intercooler in there that then takes that hot air and cools it down still under compression, so that by the time it gets around to the engine, you're pushing a lot of oxygen, nitrogen, and all this other, outside air into the intake portion of the deal, giving you a turbo boost that, makes your car go faster. So, using everything that we've talked about so far, and even going a step further, with the compressed air, your air compressors that you have at your, in your shops or whatever, if you ever check the temperatures on there, it's like ridiculous. I actually put a video in the Super Chat room about, basically temperatures on your air compressor. And if you look into how basically that's actually causing it to generate heat when you compress the air, and then think about how could you actually extract that heat, which is a necessary deal that you need to get rid of that heat, otherwise that compressor head and the electric motor will end up destroying itself from thermal breakdown. But there's people that take homemade air compressors with an after cooler, and they make use of that extra heat, for heating water, or you could actually use that heat to heat a room or something like that. Obviously, you don't want an air compressor in your bedroom while you're trying to sleep, because they're noisy as all get out. But understanding those physics, at least you can understand that's usable energy. There are water cooled screw air compressors that basically are what I'm talking about, where they're positive displacement, which whatever goes into one side is going to get forced out and compressed on the other side, but in that process there's heat generated. Those are basically used for oilless air compressors so that you don't have to worry about oiling them down. But nonetheless, they still generate heat. And so, plasma technology, when you energize gas into the fourth state of matter, you cause all them molecules to be smashing into each other, rubbing up against each other, producing friction, which in turn produces heat, that in turn produces light as well. And so now you got another form of heat energy along with radiant energy and a way to actually convert high voltage AC into high voltage DC on the other side. All we're really talking about here, folks, is transferring energy from one point to the next. I didn't really look at this video too much, but I'm going to give it a shot here.
Hi, it's Mr. Anderson, and this is AP Physics Essentials, video 18. It's on thermal conductivity, which is a property of matter that either allows it to transfer heat readily from a hot to a cold object, or it doesn't. And so the materials that I use every morning when I make coffee, it's important that they have varying amounts of thermal conductivity. So the electric kettle that I use, the element that heats up the water, is metallic because we want to transfer as much of that heat to the water as we can. But the handle that I use to pour it is plastic, and that's because it has low thermal conductivity. We don't want to transfer a lot of that heat to my hand. Likewise, the press that I press the water through the grounds is plastic, so I'm not burning my hand. And so the ability of matter to transfer heat from a hot to a cold object is called its thermal conductivity. And it's based on the structure of that material, both at the atomic and molecular level. And so if we have something like a metal that's a good conductor of electricity, it's probably also a very good conductor of heat. And the reason why is there are these delocalized electrons, and it allows that heat to move through the material. Now, nonmetals can also pass heat, and they do that not using these delocalized electrons, but using phonons, which are waves in the lattice itself. And so you should be able to calculate thermal conductivity of different materials in the AP Physics class. And so what is thermal conductivity? Well, we measure it in watts per meter Kelvin, but what it's really showing us is how heat can readily be transferred from a hot object to a cold object. And so if we have these two objects in isolation, there's not going to be heat flow between them. But if I move this metal in the middle, there's going to be the transfer of this kinetic energy from the hot object to the cold object. And the ability of that material to transfer that heat is called its thermal conductivity. And metals are very good at conducting that heat. And that's because they share their electrons in this delocalized cloud, and so the electrons are actually transferring the heat. If we were to take something like wood, it's going to have low thermal conductivity. If I were to put it between the hot and the cold objects, heat is still going to be transferred from the hot object to the cold object. But since there aren't these free electrons, it's not going to be transferred as readily. How is it moving then? Well, this whole wood is a lattice, and you get these waves inside the lattice called phonons that are actually transferring that heat. Now, you can experience this right now. So if you're standing or sitting at a table like I am, I'm going to put my hand on something that's a nonmetal, so that's going to be the surface of the table. And then I'm going to put my other hand on the bottom of my chair, which is metal, and so it's going to be a really good conductor. And the question I ask you is, which one is colder? Which one's warmer? And so when I feel those both, I feel like the table is warmer than the chair. But they're both exactly the same temperature. I wasn't touching them, so they're both at room temperature. So why does the metal feel colder than the wood? It's because it has better thermal conductivity. And so if we were to look at a few objects, copper, which is a good conductor of electricity, is also a good conductor of heat. And so we would say it has a value of 401 watts per meter Kelvin. If we were to look at something like brick, it's going to have lower thermal conductivity. Styrofoam, you know, would have really low, and so it's a fractional amount. And then a vacuum would have zero thermal conductivity. We shouldn't be able to move heat through a vacuum. Now, in an AP Physics lab, you should be able to measure thermal conductivity. And this is kind of a pretty ingenious setup on how you could do that. So what we have over here on the right is a steam generator. So it's generating steam, and that's going to move over here. So that's going to be our heat source. And it's just going to start to build up in the steam chamber. The steam chamber is enclosed on the top, and then some of the water that condenses can leak down off the bottom. And so what you do is you put some kind of material on the surface of that. So we have a plate here, in this case it's metal, and then we put some ice on the top. That ice has a consistent size, and it also, since it's frozen, is going to have a consistent temperature. You turn on the steam chamber, and what's going to happen is it's going to melt that ice. It's collected right here, and then that water can be measured. So we can look at the time and the amount of water that's being converted from a solid to a liquid. So we could measure the thermal conductivity from the steam chamber to the ice. We could then try a different object, maybe some wood, and we would see that it's going to have lower thermal conductivity. And then we could try some kind of an insulating plate as well, and we could see that that's going to even be lower amount of thermal conductivity. So it's a really quick way to measure how quickly heat is being transferred between these objects. And so did you learn to design an experiment to analyze data that will show you thermal conductivity? This is a great example, and I hope that was helpful.
Alright, cool. Alright, so, you know, what's all this talk about heat for anyway? Basically, if you understand that majority of the energy that we use, every energy that we use pretty much generates heat. So a lot of times heat is basically classed as waste, and in the laws of thermodynamics, that's one of the reasons why they try to say that you know, like something like a perpetual motion machine ain't going to be possible because of friction or heat losses or whatever, you know. But if you could actually achieve, you know, greater efficiency for anything that you want to run, you know that when you run an electric motor for quite some time, it gets hot. Well, if you can actually take away that heat by, you know, recovering that heat energy, then you can actually cause that electric motor to last a lot longer, because the only time that that electric motor is actually going to fail mechanically is due to thermal breakdowns of either the bearing or the actual insulation on the copper windings on there. So if you can keep this at a proper temperature and still be able to recover that heat energy, take it away and use it where you want, now you just made that electric motor more efficient. And so no matter what it is that you're running, whether it be your transformers, with a few modifications to any transformer, you could get this transformer to generate heat. And it doesn't sound like a whole lot until you start to understand the concept of what I was saying about the redneck hot tub. I took what was normally a coffee pot element and was able to heat a poorly insulated container of water that underneath it had it had airflow underneath it. It had airflow around all sides of it, and it was open to the atmosphere at the very top. But because I understood the physics of water, that water specific heat basically takes more energy, a longer time, not necessarily more energy, but a longer time to transfer that energy through to the water. So it took a lot more energy to get it up to, and a lot longer time to get it up to temperature, but it also took a lot longer time for that to be able to transfer that heat energy away from itself again, where all the molecules inside the water are beginning to slow down and it's cooling down. So the concept of why that worked so well, once it got up to operating temperature, I just had to keep a constant flow of energy going to that water so that it never had a chance to get cooler. It continued to rise in temperature the longer this thing would run. And like I explained, is that it would stay warm for long periods of time after you shut the power off on it. So when you sit in there too long, or if you left going too long, the water would get so incredibly hot you couldn't even get in it. The body's 98.6 degrees, and at about 103 degrees your brain starts to cook, and so you wouldn't really want to be sitting up in there. Plus it'd make you sick if the water's too hot. So, you know, maybe 100 degrees might be tolerable for a while, but anything above that, it's just pretty much not going to make you feel good. But anyway, nonetheless, it talks about how when you understand that water's specific heat is different than in other materials, and I can get that water hot and it takes longer for the water to cool down, and as long as I keep putting energy to that water, while it's already up to operating temperature, it doesn't take very much to keep it that way. It's just like a pilot light in you know, your gas stove. You'd be surprised at how much energy that how long that would actually buy you time before that gas had to kick on again, because the pilot light, even though it has a higher temperature, doesn't have as much heat energy, but it's still continuously putting energy to that tank, if you understand what I'm saying. And so understanding that concept right there will give you something for this thought experiment, to be able to maybe even run some of your own experiments to see how long, number one, that you can store heat energy, what materials are the best to do so. Compressed air, when you got a air compressor, like the video that I posted in the chat room, let me see if I can scroll up and find that doggone thing. It's in there. Basically, it shows on there the guy's using a thermal, thermometer deal to measure the temperature of it, laser thermometer, whatever those things are. I can't even remember the name of them right now. Nonetheless, let me see something real quick here. There's another video that I wanted to try to put a portion of on, if I can get to it. Okay, let's see. There it is. Let's try this one. Hopefully I'm getting zapped with a commercial, which I think this particular video is a commercial.
With nearly 100 years developing compressed air systems for all types of industries, Ingersoll Rand has the knowledge and experience to build a reliable, oil-free system to match your needs. Compressed air systems are a critical part of the manufacturing process. Ingersoll Rand's reliable products are designed to work together to help you achieve repeatable processes, produce quality products, and lower your operating costs. A lot rides on the quality of the air used in your facility. The presence of oil and moisture can lead to costly downtime, product spoilage, recalls, damage to your brand reputation, harmed consumers, and product liability. When you choose an Ingersoll Rand oil-free system, you can lower your risk and protect your reputation. Combining Ingersoll Rand's oil-free compressor with our energy-efficient heat-of-compression dryer results in oil-free air at a negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit pressure dew point, providing you with high-quality air at a very low cost of operation. Normally, heat generated during the compression process is released to the atmosphere and wasted. With an Ingersoll Rand heat-of-compression dryer, heat from the compression process is captured and used to dry the compressed air. By harnessing existing energy, our standard heat of compression dryer consumes less energy than a 150-watt light bulb, allowing it to deliver instrument-quality air at costs well below those of typical dryers. Typical heat of compression dryers have fluctuating dew points based on changes in air demand, creating moisture risk in your system and potential damage to equipment or products. Not so with the Ingersoll Rand Advanced Heat of Compression Dryer, which delivers a constant negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit pressure dew point, regardless of changes in air demand. All Ingersoll Rand products feature high-quality components and are manufactured to exacting standards. The Heat of Compression Dryer is no exception. It features patented stainless steel heat exchangers, high-performance switching valves, particulate after filters, no loss drains with auto bypass, and long-lasting, high-quality desiccant to help you achieve years of reliable performance. Beyond advanced products, Ingersoll Rand works with you as a true partner to customize solutions for your applications. We use years of industry knowledge combined with engineering experience and advanced data analysis to implement the ideal oil-free compressed air system for you. When high air quality is a high priority, the clear choice is Ingersoll Rand.
Cool. Well, you know, it's a commercial, but, you know, I'm not, like, endorsing that particular company because I don't know much about them. But what I'm trying to point out is that they took what would have normally been a byproduct of compressing air and used it to dry other air to take moisture out of the doggone, you know, buildings or whatever, so that they get better products and stuff. But anyway, the whole deal is, because they understood science and physics to that extent, there's also, I posted a video of a YouTube guy that's taking his air conditioner and using it to make a water heating system. And there, let's see, what was this one here? Now, this is what I talked about earlier.
All right, so here is your pool filter system. It's a pretty standard package. You've got two lines that come from the skimmers at the pool right here, and they come together to go through this leaf strainer to catch any leaves. And right here is the pump that's going to push water through the strainer and right through this cartridge-style filter right here. Now, the water gets filtered, and then it returns back to the pool right here. Now, at the same time, you've got the refrigerant lines right here for your air conditioner, and this is going to have hot refrigerant. We want to get the heat energy from that pipe actually into the water that's down inside here. So for that, there's a pretty ingenious invention. It's actually a heat exchanger made exactly for this reason. You can see right here that the water from the pool will come in through a pipe right here that'll go down to the bottom of the canister. The pool water will leave through this pipe and go back to the pool itself. There's a couple of refrigerant lines right here, and what you can't see is actually a coil that's down inside this canister. It's made out of titanium. That hot refrigerant goes through that titanium coil. It transfers its heat to the pool water. Now, that does a couple of things. One is it's going to heat the pool water, which is great for you, but it also is going to make the air conditioner run more efficiently.
Great.
All right, so our plumbing connections are going to start with the pool water connections to our heat exchanger. I've cut away the existing PVC. Now, this system needs to be able to monitor the temperature that's in the pool. So our first fitting is going to be this T-fitting right here. You can see there's a threaded adapter right there. Into it, I'm going to install this sensor well. Now, the sensor well will allow me to put a sensor down into the well from this side, but you can see it'll make perfect sensing of the water temperature right there. That T is going to go right here. I'm going to dry fit all this stuff right now. When I get it right, we'll go back and glue it all together. So this comes right here, and there'll be a union connection right there. All right, now on this side, we have a 2-inch coupling right here. And now we have another elbow and another half of a union right here. And now once we bring this together, so now you can see the path of the water. It leaves the filter, goes by the sensor, goes down into the heat exchanger. The heated water leaves from here and goes back to the pool. So now we can glue up these fittings. I'm putting PVC cleaner and glue on the outside of the pipe and the inside of the fitting.
Okay. Well, he's just putting stuff together right now, but I still want to leave it on here just long enough for him to say something else.
Three count. There's one.
Still gluing pipes together. Let me see if I can skip forward just a second.
Hello?
So tell us what you're doing today.
What I'm doing is I'm going to remove the refrigerant out of this air conditioning condenser, the lines, and the unit in the house using my recovery machine.
All right, so the recovery machine is actually a vacuum pump that's going to pull everything out of the system and deposit in the tank right here, right?
Correct.
All right, so I see you got, what, about 100 pounds pressure on the gauges. How long will it take to get everything out of the system?
This pump probably has to run for maybe an hour, two.
All right, I'll let you get to it.
Basically, if you had your air conditioner guy come out, you could actually modify your outside
all
air conditioner
removed,
to use
Dave
that
start making
wasted
the piping
heat
connection.
Energy.
He'll bend the pipe in the proper
pool,
configuration, dry fit all the connections, and then braze the joints. Brazing is a lot like soldering, but it uses a higher temperature gas and a different bonding material to be able to withstand those much higher temperatures and pressures that come in a refrigerant system. So, David, how are we doing?
Good. Made all my connections, pressure tested it to make sure it doesn't leak. So we are ready to recharge with refrigerant? We are. Good. Let's do it. Now, the last component of our system is this, a master controller. This is going to be the interface between the pool controller right here, our heat exchanger with its temperature sensor, and the air conditioning condenser right there. Now, it's going to mount right on the outside wall, right about over there. Yep, perfect. All right, guys, so all of our connections have been made. The plumbing connection's right here, refrigeration, we've got it wired. This is a really good time to go over the whole system. So now, whenever this air conditioner calls, it's going to check first the temperature of the pool to see if it needs to be heated. If it doesn't, then what happens is the basic refrigeration cycle that's always been here. That refrigerant comes down here, but it does one thing. It takes a little detour out through the back. You can see it comes right up through here, and it goes to this valve. It's a three-way diverting valve. And in this mode, the refrigerant comes right through back to the condenser. Now, that condenser comes on, the fan comes on, it dumps heat to outside, just like it always did. But if the pool says, I need some temperature, it'll send a signal over here, and then this valve will close this port, and instead the refrigerant will come straight through right here. It's a hot gas right now coming through here, down through this heat exchanger. It's going to heat up the pool water right here, become a little bit cooler out here, go back into the house, picks up more heat, and the cycle continues. So now, with this all connected, you're going to pay the same amount for electricity for the air conditioning as you always have. But you're going to pay nothing to heat that pool of yours.
That sounds great to me, Richard. That seems like the perfect solution
to this shady backyard.
I think it is.
Thank you very much.
Well, the thanks goes to you, Dick. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
So whereas that might cost you a little bit initially set up, you would be able to basically do two for one, kind of heat your pool and doggone it, you know, cool your house at the same exact time. And this process could be used in reverse too, whether you needed heat on one side or cold on the other side or vice versa, whatever. But understanding those basic physics of how, heat travels and the direction it'll go, you know, from hot to cold, or different, conductors of not only electricity, but actual heat as well, and the actual specific heat of any given material would tell you, if you want this to be able to transfer rapidly, or if you want it to be able to use as a battery where you're, like I mentioned with the rubber, which is, rubber is a good insulator. However, when it finally gets up to temperature, you know, rubber will get hot. Even though it's a good insulator, it will still transfer heat. And so, you know, if you get it too hot, it's like I said about that tire in the back of a pickup truck. If it sits out there in the sun all day long, it will hold that heat energy until sometime into the night before it actually finally is able to transfer that heat away from itself and cool back down to its natural temperature, or whatever the temperature is outside. Then you sit on the back of that, you get out there in the back of that pickup truck and sit on that tire, it'll burn your biscuits. So there's a good example of why I say that you can store that heat energy, and other countries have been figuring out ways to actually store large quantities of heat using these procedures in order to be able to save that heat energy for, you know, a later use. So not only can you store electricity, you can store air pressure, you can store heat energy, and I could go on if you understand the physics of how energy travels to begin with, even radiant energy from the sun. There's so many different methods by to gather up all the energy that nature has already provided anyway. And so you're just tapping into that. You're using it in a really efficient and respectful to nature's type of way, if you understand what I'm trying to say. So we talked about, this being a thought experiment, and heat batteries and materials and efficiency and storage and specific heat, which means whatever material, how much energy it takes to heat it up and how long it takes to cool it back down because of the type of material that it is. We also talked about Peltier elements and using thermal electricities with this knowledge And basically, if you want to try out what I'm saying, if you get on eBay, you can order one of those little Peltier elements. They normally come out in those little igloo coolers that you plug into your cigarette lighter. One side of it will heat the cooler to keep food warm inside, or the it'll switch a little door inside there, transfer the cold air inside there, and keep things cool. So either way, you can get a 2-for-1 out of that deal. But understanding that you can run that in backwards, cut you a little block of thick rubber, the thicker the better, maybe a half inch or whatever, quarter to a half inch thick square rubber, and glue that, or somehow affix it to one side of the Peltier element, and put a heat sink on the other side, and you set that out there in the sunlight for a while and allow the sun's radiant energy to get that rubber up to temperature, and then you can carry that thing around with you until all the heat is finally transferred from one side to the next. It'll continue to produce the Seebeck effect, producing electricity. So that's one little tiny example and an experiment that you can try yourself in order to, get more ideas. So the thought experiment is this: you've heard everything that we've talked about heat. Heat normally in a lot of systems are, not wanted, because, like your automobile per se, your automobile, I always say that if there was ever an example of over-unity, the internal combustion engine would be just that, because the internal combustion engine, because of the way it works and because of vibration and friction and, combustion, it generates so much heat that if you can't get rid of that heat, that engine will continue to heat itself up until it quite literally reaches its thermal breakdown of the weakest point of that engine and begin to fail. Eventually, it will seize itself up and destroy the engine, and potentially even crack in the block to the extent where you can't even repair it anymore. But either way, that particular example right there should give you some ideas how, if you wanted to run, let's say, a gasoline or a diesel engine, and you wanted to be able to run it 24 hours a day but keep the thing cool enough so that it doesn't begin to reach its thermal breakdown and break down the viscosity of the oil and making it to where it's going to begin to fail, then you could take that heat energy, instead of allowing it to dissipate into the atmosphere, turn that heat energy into useful deals, such as heating your water heater. Instead of having the resistive element in your water heater turning itself on, which is costing you more electricity, and also using it to heat a water supply system that would transfer that heat as in the form of radiant energy out into your house to help supplement your heating cost as well. And there's other types of materials that, like for example, they have saltwater reactors out there that are solar-powered saltwater reactors, because of the specific heat qualities of salt and water. When you get salt heated up high enough, it will actually liquefy. And it takes a long time for that liquefied salt to release that heat energy. So you can actually store heat energy using something like molten salt. And that, in conjunction with water, you get the temperature up there right enough, water will boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. And so anything above that, you're boiling it into steam, and that steam is now pressure, and so you can take that pressure and you can use it to get work done, just like you can take voltage, which is pressure, in electricity and get work done. And even the pressure itself could be stored. You could store the pressure inside of tanks that you could turn around and use for other purposes. And understanding how heat transfer actually works, you could take that high pressure tank that you got, release it rapidly into an expansion chamber, and have a cooling effect in the process. I can't remember the exact name. Let me try to Google this up. I think it's called a Trump. Basically, years ago, they had a way to make compressed air by falling water. Let me look this up real quick here. Anyway, sorry about that. It's not very good for live radio, I'm sure. And that's why it's always good to, if you ever want to join me on the radio show, it's really super simple. Just contact me on Skype. Add me as a contact on there. And you can call in and kind of, while I'm trying to search for something, be telling, you know, the research that you've got going on. That's not what I'm looking for. I think that's might be wrong spell there. Alright, excuse me for a second. Alright, let's see here. There it is. I think. Alright, so the Trump, and I will find a PDF and download or post it in the chat room so that you can take a look at it. But basically, a long time ago, they had figured out a way to take falling water, like they drill a 300-foot pipe down into a cavern, and as that water was falling, it would use the Venturi effect to pull air in with it, and then it would go down the cavern and pressurize basically like an air compressor. Okay, I found a PDF to it, so I'm going to go ahead and post this into the chat room there. And they also used it for air conditioning as well, because when you allow that pressure to release rapidly, then you get a temperature difference, a heat exchange that goes on, and basically you got free air conditioning. You know, if you take and tap into what nature's already done, let's say you need a water pump, and so you need to be able to get the water out of the tank that you dropped the water down to and then back up to wherever it was, you could use the wind or a raging river or solar power to pump the water up and fill in a reservoir that in turn... Yeah, I think I've got Ted on here. How you doing, Ted? Where you at? You got your microphone muted? I think I had Ted there for a second. I think I just... Did I hang up on him? Oh, crud. I think I did. I think I hit the wrong button. Hold on, I'll call him back. Let's do this. Now, is he calling me or am I calling him? Ted! Are you there?
I'm here.
Alright, well, I think I accidentally hung up on you. I pushed the red phone instead of the green phone.
No problem.
Let that be a lesson to you. All right, we're live, by the way.
Great.
So, basically, what I've been talking about, in case you haven't listened in or whatever, I've been talking about heat energy and different types of materials that... are you familiar with the terminology, heat-specific qualities of, given materials?
No, I've never looked into any of that.
Well, it's like, for example, rubber is a really good insulator, right? And so it takes a long time and a lot of energy to heat rubber up. But once you get that rubber hot, then it takes a long time for that rubber to be able to cool back down. You see what I'm saying? It's like water.
Yes.
Water has a higher heat-specific quality than the earth itself, because it takes more energy to get water up to temperature, but it also takes longer for that water to fall back down to its normal temperature, if you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
Alright, so that means that we got some knowledge that we can actually use in, like either thermal electrics or even being able to make you know, generators or, you know, internal combustion engines or electric motors or transformers more energy efficient by understanding those qualities of materials and the conductivity of materials like copper and aluminum being a good conductor of not only electricity, but they're also good conductors of heat energy. So now we know how to move this energy around, plus we know how to store this energy. Do you ever think about storing heat energy?
No, I never have.
Well, think about your average thermos. You know, you put your coffee in there and your coffee stays hot for a long time because there's an insulator in there that its specific heat quality is different, and so it's a poor conductor of heat energy, poor conductor of heat, and so the insulation won't allow that heat to transfer from the hot water in your coffee through the thermos and out into the atmosphere. So it takes a long time for that heat to be able to dissipate. But even in an instance where you got a thermos, that heat energy will transfer to the insulation, but it takes a long time for it to be able to do that. That heat energy wants to go somewhere. It wants to balance itself back out, but it can't. So you're able to store heat in a container for long periods of time. They've actually got large units, what they call heat battery systems and heat storage systems, that the Danish people used to, during the summertime, gather up heat in this pool that has these different types of materials underneath the water that will take that radiant heat energy and heat that water up. So now we know that the water is going to take longer to cool back down, and it's hard for it to cool back down because the rubber or the materials that they use underneath the water will store energy even longer than water. And so it continuously transfers heat and energy back and forth from the water to the material that they use under the water, plus the fact that they've got it down, you know, in the ground itself, so there's insulation factor around that, you know, minus the top of the water where it could actually, some of that energy could escape back into the atmosphere again. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
So, basically,
What kind of applications is that used for, like in technology today?
Well, heating and cooling in your house, HVAC, being able to, like for example, I played a podcast of the guy that took his air conditioner and he ran the output side of the hot gas into a system through a heat exchanger that would heat his pool. So he only had to pay to run his air conditioner, but he got his pool heated for free. And it had temperature regulating system that would shut the system off and run the air conditioner normal instead of the heat energy going into the pool. Then it would be escaping into the atmosphere like it normally does. But even in that instance, if you didn't want it to escape into the atmosphere like a normal air conditioning does, you could transfer that heat energy to wherever you want it to go. So there's so many applications, even in the thermoelectric. For example, I've been mentioning about if you get you a Peltier element and you get you a thick piece of rubber, like maybe a quarter inch or half inch thick piece of black rubber or whatever, and you cut you out a little square and affix that to one side of the Peltier element, and then a heat sink on the opposite side, you know, maybe with some thermal grease in between heat sink and the Peltier element. Set that out in the sun and allow that to charge up, that get that rubber up to temperature. Once that rubber gets up to temperature, you just created a heat battery. So you can take that heat battery out of the sun, with your oven mitt, and carry it inside the house, and it will take a while for that energy that is charged up into that rubber block on top of that Peltier element to finally transfer through to the cold side, which is the heat sink side of it. So essentially, you got a battery that basically is a mobile battery that you can until that heat finally, until the two materials are the same temperature, the Seebeck effect will continue to work and the Peltier element will continue to produce electricity. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's a simple experiment that you can try at home so that you can see basically what I'm talking about. But today's show is basically about being a thought experiment. When you understand the simple science, the basic science, and the basic and simple physics of how different materials react and how long it takes them to heat up and how long it takes them to cool down, what you wouldn't normally classify, something that was a good conductor of heat energy, rubber, even though it's an insulator, will still conduct heat energy. And when you get it up to a certain temperature, you can transfer that heat energy from the rubber to a material like aluminum tubing or, even copper or whatever metal you wanted to transfer it through, because the hot's going to go to the cold. So if you got a deal there, a place for that energy to go, it's going to eventually transfer that heat energy out of there. But you're talking about, storage, the speed at which this is actually going to cool down. So essentially what you've got right there is a heat battery. And knowing that, and knowing how different materials like iron and aluminum together, twisted together on the end, would make a thermoelectric, basically like a thermal couple or a thermal pile, and Peltier element, all of them are ways to transfer heat back into electricity using the Seebeck effect. What do you think?
That's pretty interesting. I never really thought too much into that.
So you could
consider that.
You could turn old car tires into a thermoelectric generator. And by understanding how, I don't know if you've ever had it happen, but during the summertime, you got an old tire in the back of a pickup truck, and so you jump up there in the middle of the night and sit on that tire, you thinking, it's nighttime, but that tire is still hot enough to burn your biscuits. Why is that? Because its specific heat qualities is that it takes a lot of energy to heat it up, takes longer to heat it up, but once it gets hot, it takes a long time to get it to cool down. Like, for example, what I was mentioning about if you had, a rubber hose shoved into a piece of copper tubing, you could hang on to that rubber hose, and you could heat the copper tubing on the opposite side, and the copper tubing could get really, really hot, and it would take a long time for that heat to actually transfer through to that rubber. So you could sit there and hold, a real hot copper tube on the other end using that rubber. However, if you heated that rubber and got it past its, temperature, where you could no longer touch the rubber, you could grab a hold of the copper on the other side if it was cool, and you could hold it in the opposite direction, but eventually that heat would transfer from that rubber into that copper and make it too hot to handle. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it works in both directions. But knowing that, and knowing how heat pump systems and heat transfer systems work, and being able to take all these this knowledge of different types of materials, whether they're conductive or insulative or whatever, we can now use that knowledge to take your average internal combustion engine or electric motor or electric transformer and transfer this energy so that what would have normally been an obnoxious loss in the system now becomes a plus, making that system more efficient. What do you think?
I love the way your mind works, is this?
Well, the whole thing is...
That's why I call you, because I want to learn something today.
In order to get to what we call free energy, which is we're surrounded in it. We're floating in a sea of free energy, and a lot of times when you say that, there are people out there so highly educated, they're saying, oh, well, that's just a hock-a-hoo or whatever. They try to get all foul mouth heathen on you because they don't get it. But everything around is energy, and anything that's carbon based is basically fuel source. So just pretty much everything's fuel source or it's energy, one way or the other. So your body is a thermoelectric generator. You ever wondered how you're able to turn calories, which by the way is the measurement of how you turn energy from heat, how many calories it takes to generate so much heat that actually, you know, does whatever you want it to do. Your body's 98.6 degrees. It's got different materials inside there. So it's actually a thermoelectric generator. That's where you get your electricity from. And not to mention whatever outside sources you might get electricity from. But I would be willing to bet that very few people even think about where the electricity comes from that your brain uses to send signals down to the nerve endings of your body to tell you that you just stubbed your toe. You ever think about that?
No.
Well, once you understand the physics and the chemistry and the basic simple of all of it, it's all so ridiculously simple. Now we can take all that knowledge and we can take this thought experiment and see how far we could actually expand this. Knowing that we could gather up heat during the summertime to carry us through the wintertime, not only can we store the radiant energy in the form of heat in underground containing units at large quantities where we can tap into that heat energy, because until that energy is transferred away, it's still energy that is usable. And the same way we can actually take energy that the solar through solar panels stored in batteries and capacitor banks underneath the ground as well, and now we got different types of energy, you know, ready at our disposal. And even during the winter time when it's not hot outside and you got the wind blowing outside, you're still putting more energy into the system. And even ice has energy to it. So people don't realize that just because it's cold doesn't mean it doesn't have energy going on. And so once you get all that figured out, now you understand how to take every single thing that nature does, even things that you do, you know, to generate energy that can actually be stored. So you can turn your entire house into a super efficient, self-contained system using this type of knowledge. So when you got, let's say, your attic up there, and that attic is getting extremely hot in there, and that's why you have to have vents in your attic so that you can get rid of that heat. Otherwise, people's roofs would be blowing off their off their house if that energy didn't have nowhere to go. Because once you like you got a closed container, you heat it up, what's it do? It expands. So now that expansion is going to cause that energy's got to go somewhere. And if you're continuously putting heat into it and you got a sealed container, you know, it's going to start, you know, expanding out because of whatever atmosphere inside there, you know, it's pressurizing. So, you know, you could turn that, what would have normally been something to be a pain in the neck that you had to get rid of, into a useful energy source. There's all kinds of ways to actually take the temperature difference from the actual roof itself. If you could visualize thermoelectric system right underneath the, right at the attic roof itself, you're transferring that heat energy from the temperature difference between the outside with the direct sunlight beating down on it to the inside, which could only be maybe a few degrees difference from the outside, but enough that it causes the Seebeck effect to put electricity through things. What do you think? Ted, did I lose you?
I like the way your brain thinks. I mean, you got a very systems, whole systems approach.
Well,
and it's like overwhelming sometimes because of how much it is that you think into, but you know, I like it because it's, in reality, I mean, it's a whole systems approach that makes everything what it is today. So
Yeah.
You know, if we can, if however it's fine, thank you.
Yeah.
So as long as that's going on, I mean,
and I'll take a large
really
strawberry
like
shake.
Is that?
Oh, was you at the restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, I'm here running my errands, just as,
yeah.
I'd never like to not get on the line with you on a Saturday.
I'm hollering out there. I say I'll take a large strawberry shake.
Yo, I get you on. You want strawberry, you say?
Yeah.
No problem.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry I interrupted you. I just heard somebody
in
the back.
All I'm thinking is that whole systems approach is pretty important. I mean, I know when I listen, sometimes when I first heard it, it's overwhelming and like too much to think about. But the more I get to thinking about technology and science, I mean, it is a whole systems approach. It doesn't matter if it's agriculture, energy, medicine, whatever aspect we're into in life, like, you need that whole systems approach. Just to say, like, here's a Bedini motor and it charges a battery, that's a beautiful thing. A lot can be grown off that. But
yeah,
it is the whole systems approach that is what's needed, to be honest. I mean, there's a lot of people upset about the environment. You know, there's a lot of people upset about the Trump making all these whatever industrial decisions or whatever. It's like people getting all weird. And it's like, well, if we take a whole systems approach like you're doing, I mean, all this can be done way more efficiently and cleanly. I just hope one day somebody listens.
Well, yeah, imagine if you had a heat exchanger up in the attic of your house, and you could actually take that heat energy, and you know that heat rises, even in the the winter time, you still got some solar power that whenever that radiant energy makes it through, you know, even the cold air, it will actually heat materials up even in the winter time as long as the sun's out. Well, you could transfer that heat energy to the basement knowing that heat's going to rise and use that to help supplement your heating bill. Not to mention the fact that, you know, if you want your hot water heater to never kick on the element, which is a resistive load, or even the gas hot water heaters as well, you would save more energy by transferring the heat from the roof of your house down in through your water heater to cool, to heat that up and keep that temperature up. And then even when the excess heat from that system, because like I said in that hot redneck hot tub, maybe it takes a long time because of the specific heat qualities of water and as much atmosphere was not only below it, but beside it and all around it, that it took longer to heat that water up, but at that same sense, it also took longer for that water to cool back down to its normal, outside temperature. So using something as simple as a coffee pot element, I was able to start heating up this water, circulate the water from the hot tub around back into the hot tub, and that energy, heat energy, would transfer over a period of time, maybe about 4 hours, it'd be up to operating temperature. Now you had the water up to operating temperature. You could sit in a warm hot tub even in the dead of winter. But even in the dead of winter, because I left the thing continuously running, that heat energy is constantly adding to the system, and eventually that water would get so hot that you couldn't sit in there even when there was snow on the ground outside because it was too hot to get in. And you actually had to let it cool down, which took a little bit of time. That's basically why I did the redneck hot tub video, to show efficiency and a heat energy storage system. So whereas most people just thought it was an old redneck making a hot tub with junk, what I had was an actual message there about how you could actually store heat energy and be able to use it for another purpose. You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So when I tell people about my YouTube channel, that you're going to see some crazy stuff on there, but if you actually use it as a thought experiment, when you see this crazy stuff and you ask the questions of what is actually possible, how far could we take this knowledge? I'm saying that on best case scenario, we could take this knowledge to the extreme where every single house out there was not only weatherproof, earthquake proof, flood proof. We could make these houses so incredibly efficient that there wouldn't be no such thing as wasted energy. You know, because you could use everything from the siding of the house to the roofing of the house to either insulate or transfer energy to where you wanted it to go. You know that copper is a good conductive of heat energy and electricity. And so you could actually design a roof to not only be a thermal electric generator, but be a thermal water heater as well. So the energy that you're extracting from that heat energy that can in turn go down and run different appliances that would have normally took more energy to run by the method that they're using, such as a resistive element in your hot water heater or even in your kitchen stove for that matter. You could transfer that heat energy to wherever you wanted it and store it so that you could actually use stored heat to actually cook with. What do you think of that?
I dig it.
So, when the wind's blowing outside, you're storing energy. You can store energy in the form of air pressure, heat, and electrical, or whatever. So it's not like there's no shortage of ways to store energy. Once you understand the materials and how they interact with different types of materials, you know how to insulate the best, and you know that even insulation can conduct heat energy. So you wouldn't think about it, but the more it resists heating, you know, the longer it takes to heat it up, the longer it's going to take to cool it down. So something that you would least likely think that would be a good conductor of heat, you use it to, like the rubber did I explain that, you can use it to insulate your hand from that hot pipe. However, if that thing goes up to temperature, you couldn't do that. You see what I mean? So,
absolutely.
Things that we use for insulation, when they get up to their temperature, imagine how long it would take for those to cool back down. If water takes a long time to cool back down, or any materials like rubber or plastics take a long time to cool back down, imagine how long it would take to cool down something like hot styrofoam or whatever. You see what I mean?
Absolutely, I do.
Because the physics apply forward and reverse, and even things like salt. You get molten salt. Think about how long it's going to take to cool back down. And as that energy's transferring from one place to the next, if you understand the basic concept of thermoelectrics, like the Seebeck effect, you can make even that effect really efficient. The backs of your solar panels, when it's heating on the front, those solar panels get hot and they lose some efficiency because of that heat. So if you can cool those solar panels down or take energy off the back of those solar panels, so you still got two different types of energy going on, but it's still all, storable energy. It's unlimited. It's only limited by your imagination. If you got a basic understanding of how energy actually travels, this is what I'm actually trying to help you figure out here. Get everybody to the point where, you could take a look at something, like something as simple as a permanent magnet motor being able to run backwards and use as a generator that particular concept, and even an old car tire that, people try to get rid of them all day long. Some people grind them up and put them into asphalt. If you ever felt the asphalt during the summertime, even during the wintertime. Summertime worse, because it'll capture that heat and it'll hold that heat, which in turn, that heat's transferring up to the bottom of your car, making your car have to work harder, But it'll keep the road thawed out for the most part. But either way, because of that particular type of material, and the tire itself, the color of the tire, it's a heat battery. So it normally is trash. Once you get a stack of these things and you got to pay somebody to get rid of them, then you might want to reconsider getting rid of them at all, because now you got an energy storage system in a form of an old car tire that, in worst case scenario, you could use the sun to You know, imagine taking some black rubber hose or something and winding it up real tight inside of a car tire, drilling a hole through the actual tire, and putting the ends of the hose out of it, and then screwing it into a system where you got a pump that'll circulate it through a radiator inside your house. So it, when the sun's out there beating on that doggone tire, it's going to continue to store heat, and that heat's going to continue to build up. It's going to transfer through to the rubber hose, which is also going to take a long time to cool back down. And so now you got a thermal water heater that you didn't have to do nothing but, you know, get an old tire and an old black rubber hose to, you know, build. And if you want to fill in that space in between the tire that you normally would have your rim in there, you know, you could probably even put a rim back on there and spray paint the rim black. But either way, you could put other types of materials that would gather up other types of energy that would also add to the heat of that tire. And so there you go. Now, like, imagine if you had a some sort of heating system where you're burning firewood, and you got these tires that are not actually connected to the stovepipe of it, but it's sitting there close enough around that stovepipe to where that radiant energy that would have been lost from the stovepipe is actually transferred to the rubber. Keep in mind, that's probably something you want to do outside in case you have some sort of chimney fire. You don't want to start a tire fire as well, because it could be bad, but just using it for a simple example. That radiant heat would transfer through the rubber of the tire, getting that tire really, really hot. So you're not only using the radiant energy from the stove itself, but you're also using the escaping heat that is coming out of the doggone stovepipe, which is the exhaust pipe out to the atmosphere. And you're reusing that energy a second time. And you could even reuse it a third time by guiding that stovepipe, you know, into whatever direction that you wanted it to, you know, do so much. They say that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. And so all you're doing is you're transferring energy from one to the next. And knowing that, you know, heat will go to cold, or, you know, low pressure to high pressure, whatever, high pressure to low pressure, all these concepts and the types of materials, different ways of generating electricity, whether it be thermoelectrics, hydroelectrics, wind power or solar power, or, you know, whatever, taking all these things in conjunction with each other and stepping back and look at the big picture, you're standing on a gold mine of electricity if you understand how these things function. And there's other alternatives where you can repurpose your junk into not only either fuel or usable devices for generating electricity, and even to the extent of how you use that electricity, as opposed to maybe, you know, current watts and amps that you'd use in your normal, you know, 50 to 60 hertz electric outlet on your wall. Well, these higher voltages at higher RPMs and even number of turns on the secondary from a transformer, like a microwave oven transformer, where you ramp the voltage up, you ramp the frequency up, and now this energy will not run your electric fan because it's moving too fast. And so you got to figure out a way where you can store it and slow it down. Therefore, a transformer is a way to do that. But also, at that point, when you get high voltages, and this voltage is moving rapidly, the magnetic field lines moving that fast going through there, it's the same way that a microwave oven cooks the food by rocking those water molecules back and forth so rapidly. So you can use the high frequency waves of it to generate heat, and you can also use the pressure and the friction of that energy going across the given material or object to generate yet even more heat. So My suggestion to you is if you ever mess around with Tesla coils and you got that high voltage arc jumping across the spark gap, never, ever, ever, ever under any circumstances, even after it's turned off, rush right over there and grab a hold of that spark gap, because you're going to burn a blister the size of Texas on your finger, because that high voltage, high frequency produced a lot of heat energy. And that high voltage and high frequency, when going through any type of noble gas, will energize that gas into the fourth state of matter, causing those molecules to rub against each other so rapidly that they will, in turn, between all the exchange of electrons back and forth and slamming into each other, generate the plasma, which generates heat, which generates light. And so now you get several processes of different types of energy going on at the same time, not excluding radiant energy from that process. It's amazing. And so if I can get this particular mindset out there through this thought experiment that I'm doing here today on the Mad Science Show, and we can actually get people together who want to work on different types of systems, we can show everybody in this world how to turn junk into treasure by utilizing what would have normally been something that went to the scrapyard or the dump for either energy to distill water for fresh drinking water, or energy to use for thermal electrics for running lighting, or even energy to turn a turbine, because we know that heat rises and cold air falls. So if you put a hot air plume up a turbine, it's going to cause that turbine to spin even when the wind isn't going. And what can you do with that? You can take that and go so many different directions. And once you understand heat and convection and conduction and all this kind of stuff, then now you know where you want to move that energy to do whatever task you want it to do. It's amazing. It's mind-blowing. So, what do you think, Ted? Are you still there? I think I lost Ted again. But nonetheless, there you go. The super efficiency of what we could actually accomplish as a society to be able to transfer energy to where we want, to get the work that we want done, understanding pressure and everything, and the different types of materials and the different types of storage. You could store pressure, you could store electricity, you can store heat, any type of energy whatsoever, and in the process of using energy, you actually generate yet even more heat. Isn't that crazy? So anytime there's any work being done, there's always something occurring. Until you get perfectly precision bearings, then you'll have vibrations. Those vibrations will, shake around the atoms of whatever material that it's spinning around and cause that to generate some heat from that vibration. And the actual friction of even the bearings going through the oil across the race of the bearing seat, that it's generating some amount of friction, which eventually transfers that heat energy to the oil that is actually lubricating the bearing. So you've got to make sure that the viscosity of the oil itself doesn't finally break down, and then you get a thermal breakdown of not only the oil or lubricant in that bearing, it starts to eat into the actual bearing in the seat itself, and eventually that thing will fail. But if you can keep it from reaching its thermal breakdown, it will never fail. And so if you understand the simples of it, that between the thermal breakdown, the specific heat qualities of a given material, the conductive qualities of any given material, and all that kind of stuff combined, you can take and engineer the perfect machines to utilize what would have normally been something that was destructive, which is heat. Heat is destructive, but it's very useful at the same exact time. And if you get that all down together, now you got machines that instead of using this heat energy to be just basically let go out into the atmosphere, then you transfer that energy where you want it to go. You're in control now. And instead of these engines tearing themselves up, you're taking your average internal combustion engine, you're using the whatever fuel input you want to produce enough torque to actually turn a generator head to make electricity, and depending on how you use that electricity with all this knowledge that you just gained, you can make that thing so incredibly efficient that even the heat that is generated by all the processes that's going on in that engine is heating the water in your hot water heater. It's heating a coolant system that is being circulated in and out of your house and taking and transferring all that excessive heat energy into some other use around there. So your every single thing that you're doing, including running your refrigerator is heating up your hot water heater, and your air conditioning unit is heating up your hot water heater or your swimming pool. This engine that you're running is producing enough electricity to run all these other processes, with the exception is they don't have to have that energy coming out of that particular generator because of the fact that your air compressor that you're running in your garage is using the compression of air to transfer heat energy into a system that otherwise would have had to turn on and then add a load to that generator. So you're taking all that heat energy that was on that engine on the, let's say, a 2,500 watt generator, and instead of having to run your hot water heater, resistive element load, which is going to draw amperage and wattage away from that generator, make it have to work harder, it's taking that heat energy and heating up that water so that the element never kicks on. The same thing with your air compressor or whatever. You know, wherever you transfer that doggone energy, if you got a supplementary system to that, whatever that energy is necessary to do, like your heating system, if you're taking the heat from that that generator, that's either through the exhaust or the actual engine block itself, or from the the combustion portion of the deal, whatever heat is generated through that, you transfer it in through a radiator system that then in turn makes it so that your resistive load heaters never have to come on. And if they did have to come on, it'd only be for a short period of time until more heat was generated by the system itself. So you could essentially, doing what I'm talking about, design your house to one 2,500 watt generator being more than enough BTUs to heat the house, cool the house, run all your lighting systems in the house, and use the electricity in a completely different form than 50 or 60 hertz, running it so that you're transferring that energy away so that you're reducing the lens effect that would be occurring during the natural time of the normal way that you would actually run that generator. So the amount of energy that you're using right now is quite unnecessary and quite ridiculous when you understand that you could take these physics right here from the heat battery that we talked about, storing that energy, to the types of materials that are conductive, or the specific heat factors of each one of them, that once you get them hot, they stay hot for long periods of time. And the way that you can actually take that material once it's hot and insulate it away from the atmosphere and hold it in there, store that heat energy. And it's still energy. And we haven't even got into nuclear power, where the actual waste of nuclear energy, when these radioactive rods that they put in the pools for 10 years are still releasing energy, which is generating heat, so they're not efficient enough to actually run a steam generator to run turbines at this point in the game, so now they're considered depleted fuel rods. but they're still producing energy. And using this type of knowledge right here, you could transfer that energy into materials that would otherwise be insulators that would store that energy for long periods of time. Well, after this particular process stopped with the radioactive rod. So you have a safe way by which you could actually transfer the energy that's being released from those radioactive rods into a different type of material, and using the knowledge of what materials are more conductive, transfer that heat energy rapidly, like through copper tubing. It don't take long for copper to get hot, and it will allow that energy to flow fast. And so using that process, you could transfer that other heat energy from one step to the next step, which is the specific heat quality of, like, say, rubber or something like that, or even plastics that would have normally went into the landfill. You can actually put them in containment units and actually use this to, when it gets up to a certain melting temperature, it actually melting. So you got molten it's not flaming on fire, but it's really melted hot plastic that's going to hold its heat for a long time, take longer to cool down, and transfer that heat to a different source such as rubber or whatever you want, and then turn around, circulate cool water through that, which would then in turn transfer that heat from those pipes into the doggone water and move it on down the road. And at a certain amount of temperature, 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, then you can start turning that into steam pressure as well. So even the process, it might take a little bit longer to do than a brand new fuel rod turning water into steam. It's still going to be exponential growth in the actual energy that is transferred from one system to the next and stored, just like pressure in a capacitor, and that energy has to go somewhere. So it took a long time to heat up that doggone redneck hot tub, but once it got heated up, it took a fraction of the energy that it took to begin with to get it to that temperature, to maintain it, and even exceed the temperature that it was safe to actually set in that hot tub. So, you back there yet, Ted? I think Ted passed out. I hope you're all right, brother. Anyway, there you go. Compressed air, when you compress a gas, it produces heat. Pretty much every process that we do produces some sort of energy in the form of heat. And in the mainstream energy places, they like to call these losses. I like to call them a positive, because it's only waste if you don't use it. And so we can actually take any type of energy, we can store it, we can change energy to different forms of energy. We have the technology available to us right now to make the perfect, efficient machines, the perfect self-contained, efficient houses, or, you know, even to the extent, like I mentioned earlier, houses that will not be blown over in high winds, that they're aerodynamic, they're earthquake proof, they're flood proof, so they'll float, they'll cut through the wind. And yeah, you got a house where you can go to sleep at night and it's already keeping its own energy from the solar energy that's being transferred to whatever material you made this house out of, and then that energy is transferred into different types of material that in turn are using thermoelectrics to charge systems up, or even heating water systems, so that your hot water heater in your house isn't going to ever have the resistive element kicked on, and the lighting, and, you know, heat is a light and light is heat, vice versa. And if you figure all that kind of stuff out, you can make the perfect house that will take care of itself and you. So how you doing there, Ted? I was talking to you earlier, but then I thought maybe you might went to sleep. I missed your message.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I stepped out for a second here, get some support the local farmers here while they're operational here for another minute or two at the farmer's market.
Cool.
Yeah, but, I mean, life is good, Shaziz. You know, I mean, I'm doing good. I hope you're doing good, too.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I'm just trying to put a thought experiment out there to the world so that people, if they really seriously want free energy, they know how to get it. If they really seriously want efficiency and reduce carbon footprints, even though you know how I feel about the old climate change thing, carbon taxes, all that really, never mind, it's all hockahooey, but nonetheless, using real science, real physics, and real knowledge of natural occurrences, what nature does, we have every single piece of the puzzle necessary to make the perfect, efficient machines that we can use to get the same kind of, to keep the style, luxury style that we're accustomed to, so to speak.
Be familiar with this guy, oh, his name just escaped my head right as I'm going to say it. It's Thomas, I forget his name. I'll have to send you a link to him. But he's this dude on YouTube, and it seems a lot of people have gone with the thought experiment of, taking a brushless motor, or DC motor, and using a DC pulse to run it.
Yeah.
And bring down your, just like Gerard Moran's doing, but not, instead of like him not showing people how to do it or just saying, I've shown you how to do it, like there's quite a few people that are still teaching people how to do this. And the one design I was looking at recently, the guy's using what's called an H-bridge, a three-phase H-bridge, and I'd never heard of an H-bridge before.
Well,
have you?
Yeah, I have, but I right off the top of my head.
Have you heard of it?
Huh?
You've heard of a three-phase H-bridge?
Yeah, but right off the top of my head, I can't grasp it.
It's got MOSFETs in it. It's got six MOSFETs in it. It's got gates that open and close, and it can be used as a three-phase controller or motor controller.
Yeah.
So that H-bridge, you can decide how much voltage you want to push, and using a controller, you can decide at, what frequency or how fast you're going to push that voltage.
Yep.
And so the H-bridge allows you to make your own custom electronic motor controller that will put in a high voltage pulse into your brushless DC motor instead of a low voltage pulse with high amperage. Like these 24-volt DC brushless motors. Well, you start putting 450 volts in there at the same pulse timing, low amperage, and these things move, like Gerard Moran has shown.
Yep. And imagine if you understand what it takes to actually get current in a through a pipe, a certain volume of water or a certain volume of electricity through a thick gauge of wire. Once you understand how that process actually what it takes to get current, then you can understand that if you took multiple high voltage power sources using the same process that you're just talking about, basically using MOSFETs or transistors for fast-acting switches, it's going to produce a high-voltage, high-frequency wave, and you're sending multiples of these into the same pipe at the same time down into a storage tank, you got your current back again. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
With less input than it would have took otherwise to try to cram all that current through there because of the resistance, you lose things in the process. Well, they say you lose things, but you're really not losing. You're actually generating heat. That's why the back of a transistor gets so hot. But if you're not forcing that transistor to work harder than it needs to in order to generate the specific amount of voltage, if you're not drawing a lot of current on there, that transistor will never get hot. It will never reach its thermal breakdown. And even if, to the extent of putting heat sinks on the back of them to take that heat energy away from that transistor, you still have that energy. You haven't lost it. If, as long as you're not allowing it to go off into the atmosphere, which is back into nature again, then you haven't lost it. So there is no losses in any system, no matter how hard they try to tell you that it's not possible because of all the losses in the system. Well, if you know there's going to be a loss in the system, then why not monopolize on that loss and turn it into another form of energy, such as, maybe the back of every single transistor that's going to get hot. You have a Peltier element smack dab on that thing, and it's transferring that heat energy through to the Peltier element, which is then transferring that heat energy through to a heat sink and using that energy a second time around. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So we know about the Seebeck effect. That's how we got thermoelectrics, thermocouples, thermopiles, Peltier elements. Oh man, I love this stuff. It's like my brain is going 10 million miles an hour, man. So what do you think?
Well, I love it. I think I'm going to work with the H-bridge motor controller idea and start to spin generator heads.
Yep, and it depending on how you want to pull that power off of there will determine on how successful. See, people are trying to take a one electric motor to run a generator head to make a motor generator. But the way that they're pulling that power off makes it inefficient because of the resistance that's going on and the clogging effect and all this kind of stuff. But if they understand what it is that I'm saying right here and what Gerard Morin and even Bedini and John Searle and Joseph Newman and all these other guys have been saying, it's how you're extracting that energy off of that doggone system is going to determine how hard the input system, which is the electric motor, is going to have to work. And when the harder it has to work, you're not able to pull out as much energy as you actually put into it. So they classify that as a loss. But imagine that generator, the electric motor that's running that generator, is spinning that generator up at higher than normal RPMs, and instead of trying to push current out that thing, it's pushing high voltage out that current, which we just got through explaining that that energy is still the same energy. You haven't lost anything at this point through resistance, and the higher that voltage gets, the less things that can resist high voltage. You see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
And Anon92210 said in the chat room, I mean solar panels are free energy, right? Almost. It's free energy. Once you own that doggone solar panel, and even if you make your own solar panels or thermoelectric devices, you didn't pay for the sun. You know, it came down. You didn't pay for the wind. You didn't pay for the rain. So you can get electricity from the rain using the Lord Kelvin style system, you know, because as that water's falling down, you can extract high voltage out of the air, static electricity and stuff. So, you know, he said we'll need to make super efficient solar panels. That was Anon9210. That's where, once you understand what actually makes that solar panel inefficient, now you know how to make it efficient by keeping it cool. See, if you can visualize a solar panel, it's out there in the atmosphere, so it's got the atmosphere out there to, basically blow wind across it and keep it to some extent cool. But even after a certain period of time of the sun beating down on it, the materials inside there are getting so incredibly hot, and if you ain't got a more efficient way to transfer that heat energy away from that doggone solar panel, it loses efficiency. But imagine if you had this solar panel sitting in a running stream of water where the water is all crystal clear and it's taking that heat energy away. It takes a long time for that water to heat up, but then at a certain point when you're recirculating this around, this water will get to a certain temperature where now it's no longer making the solar panel efficient. So when that moment that water gets up to that particular temperature, you guide it off into a storage tank and put fresh cold water in there to bring that efficiency back up of the solar panel. So you're constantly moving energy away from what you need to be efficient and towards a storage tank or some other place where you need to be able to use that water. But if those solar panels are down in the water, not only is the refraction from the sunlight coming in dispersing more equally across that solar panel using like fiber optics, how fiber optics work, you're getting that even dispersion of light energy transferred down to the solar panel, but you're taking away the excess heat with that water and keeping that solar panel cool. If it's cool, it works just like a thermoelectric. When these two particular pieces, different types of metal, are heated and they get hot, they'll produce the Seebeck effect, producing electricity. But once those two pieces of metal reach the same temperature, the hotter the both of them get closer to temperature they get to each other, the less the Seebeck effect works. And so if you can keep them constantly temperature different so that they never can reach the same temperature, then they will always produce that effect, produce an electrical charge. So every bit of what we're talking about, you talk about making more efficient solar panels, more efficient thermoelectric systems, everything that all the materials that your houses are made of. If you understand what I explained earlier about the specific heat, basically the factors of whatever type of material you got, the specific heat quality, or what's the word I was looking for, dad burning. I hate it when that happens. Either way, each different type of material takes a certain amount of energy to heat it up, which means it takes a certain amount of time for it to cool back down. May take longer to heat it up, may take more energy to heat up, but once you get it there, that's why that redneck hot tub was working so efficiently, because once I got it up to operating temperature, it took me 4 hours to get it there, but once I got it there, it took very little to maintain it and actually get it to the point where I had to shut the element off. Otherwise, the water gets so doggone hot, you'd boil yourself trying to sit in that hot tub. That's how that works.
I called about the treadmill.
Huh?
I called the treadmill off you.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll be here in a second. I'm on the phone. Thank you.
So, there we go. You got a treadmill now?
I'd like to get your brushless motor at your local second-hand junk store. Ours is called Bubba's Garage.
Yeah, they got a permanent magnet. I think it's like 24 or 30-volt permanent magnet motor in there that you can turn into a generator.
I'm going to use it as my primary mover on my generator head. I'm going to make a Gerard Moran motor controller using an H-bridge and a step-up transformer, and I'm going to a motor controller, and I'm going to run that treadmill at a really intense... It's going to add torque and RPMs to it, and I'm going to run it 3,600 rotation, turn me a little generator head, give me a little power.
Cool. Well, I'm going to throw in a quick tune and take a quick... refresh break. Give me some more coffee, and then I'll be back to polish off the show. You want to stick around there, Ted, or what?
Yeah, I'll be back in a few. Sounds good.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. You listen to Mad Science.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugs if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raise on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. Came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly.
how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway night, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
I didn't hear no ruckus. Did you hear a ruckus, Ted? Ted. I think Ted went to sleep. He might be out there on that new treadmill he's got. But anyway, basically been trying to share a thought experiment with everybody to look farther into what would have normally been classified as waste energy, turning it into a plus instead of a minus. So as far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as waste energy if you're not using it. So with that said, I'm working on a system right now to where I can actually, probably through a platform like Twitch, be able to live stream and do the radio show at the same time, so that I'd be able to show you more things and make this a more interactive experience for everybody. So there'd actually be another chat room available, plus there would be a live stream and I can sit there and show you projects and stuff. Almost like the virtual labs thing that I've been trying to get accomplished for a while. So it might take me a bit to get it all sorted out, but once I do and I got the computers all in place where I can sit there and as I'm trying to explain something to you, I can show you. And then if you have questions about how to make something, we can work on it together. and troubleshoot ideas, and that's what my ultimate goal is, to hopefully help you, to help me, to help everybody else, to become super efficient as far as how we use energy, and even have a greater understanding of how energy actually works, to the extent of the resources available, to be able to work in perfect harmony with nature, and to actually gather what I call the dream team. It's all the brilliant minds from all different places to come together and, you know, invent and create and design new ways and new methods to give everybody in the world that they wanted, the clean, renewable, alternative, sustainable energy. So in my mind, it's already done deal. I understand how energy travels, and it's ridiculous to watch the world continue to make the same exact mistakes over and over and over again. That's why mad science exists. You know, when the mainstream science is saying one thing and science actually proves out to be something completely different, or even in the energy industry when they're making money hand over fist at the, basically on the backs of the people, and then trying to charge the people yet even more money for electricity, it's frustrating, because there's so much energy to go around. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. And I don't care how well educated you believe yourself to be, more like a more indoctrinated, because what the school book says, and you use the laws of physics to your disadvantage, because it pretty much tells you that the things you can't do. When in reality, what those known laws of physics, or acceptable laws of physics, according to the mainstream science, is, if you understand the cause and effect, you understand whenever you want to invoke Lenz effect to the extent where you're using it for regenerative braking, or, whatever, just braking in general, where you can actually use a magnetic field to, generate a second magnetic field that's going to counteract the first and stop your wheel from turning in an electric car or whatever. Just by understanding those simple concepts. And, there's things little tricks of it all that if we bring these things together, you'd be surprised at what you can accomplish. And there, I can't remember exactly what they call it, but whenever they were putting like windmills up, they'd actually short the coils together so that it would produce enough braking effect, because as that windmill is trying to turn because of the wind, it can't turn because it's invoking the Lenz effect by that shorted coil, and so it acts as a brake long enough to get that wind turbine up, and then when you release that, it starts to generate electricity again. So Anon said, don't worry, Shaz is, I am working on gathering people for the dream team right now as we speak. As you speak, that's wonderful. That's what I like to hear, because if we get the dream team together, doesn't matter which project they want to work on, if we can just agree to work on each project, and go full force with all of our knowledge to making that one project successful, and even if we find a point where we got a sticking point where we got to try to find a resolution, we can still set that on the side, not give up on it, but everything we've learned from it, and then when somebody new comes along, might have the piece of puzzle necessary to resolve that one little issue, or we can research it to resolve, then there's a product that's already ready to go, and we all did it together. That's what the Dream Team's all about. Bringing all the brilliant minds from all around the world and solving the so-called energy crisis of the world, the new, clean, renewable, green energy, whatever you want to call it. I'm saying we got all the pieces of the puzzle ready. It's just a matter of whether or not we're ready to work together to make it happen. How you doing, Ted? I can hear you're back.
I'm doing good, Shaziz. Glad to be back. I got my $40 treadmill because I got a brushless motor now.
Cool. Was you out there trying it out?
Was that?
Was you out there trying it out?
It wouldn't turn on. He had it outside, so I got $20 left. I paid $40 for it instead of $60.
Well, that's cool.
Because it didn't turn on, but I'm pretty sure that motor's still good.
Oh, yeah. There's very, very little that could have went wrong with that motor. Only two possibilities. One would be somebody banged on the side of the motor and knocked loose one of the magnets, which is an easy fix. All you got to do is take the motor apart and put the magnet back in, you know, glue it back into place, and then that motor's good again. The only other possibility is the actual electrical winding. Somehow they got it too hot and it burned off the insulation, which is a very rare occurrence in that type of motor. So with that said, I'm pretty positive you got a really good motor, and it can be used for your power source that you want in your generator. So, it's a good buy.
Thanks, bro.
Not to mention you got all those other pieces of that treadmill that you can use as well for other projects.
Yeah, I'm going to make a conveyor. If I had to buy more of these one day, I'm going to put all the treadmill thing and make a conveyor belt for some kind of operation. I like conveyor belts. I always have.
Yeah, I actually took one of those treadmills and built a deal to pull duckweed out of a pond by using it like a conveyor system and having the one end down into the pond, and it would circulate the water towards itself, and then with the paddles pick up duckweed and drop it on the shoreline.
Oh, yes. I love that.
So that's one method. And if you built it like a comb instead of a paddle like I had, it would have been better because, you know, like a comb will allow the water to be able to go through and still pick up the duckweed at the same time, as long as the teeth of the comb were like real close together, you know, where, you know, you could grab a whole duckweed and such. But where there's a will, there's a way. And that's what I like to hear. Creativity, that's what I like to hear. Repurposing what would have otherwise went in the junk. So,
that's right.
Well, you got any thoughts on the matter?
Which matter in Pacific?
Any matter, man. This is an open floor. I need to take a breath.
Well, I'm not, this guy Thomas, I think B-U-I-S-E, something like that. Who's
Bearden?
I forget how he's...
Tom,
anyways.
Tom Bearden?
No, B-U-I-S. This is a poor dude.
Oh, okay.
He said that he has died a couple times, and one of the times he died, he's seen this device. So he notarized it and mailed it to himself after he wrote it down right after he came into out of his coma or whatever. And he's just like... Anyways, he's got a YouTube channel. His device is called A to Z Motor.
Yeah.
And I forget what the... I'll look it up and tell you the exact name of it.
Yeah, just throw me a link in sometime. But it's
like, this guy here is pretty legit. And a friend of mine sent me a video that he's got unlisted. And it's like, he's asking people for a $10 donation or whatever. And to see the video. So it's there, it's just unlisted. And it's got a pretty nice little... Well, not a nice diagram, it's a horribly drawn diagram. But it explains the... explains the concept pretty well. I understand why it's charging a couple bucks for it. I mean, it's pretty much exactly what Gerard Moran's doing, and I think I've told you about it. I mean, he's using a motor controller, and instead of using 24 volts at high amperage, he's wired up the motor controller to an H-bridge, so it does the firing.
Yeah.
And then that's able to fire a high voltage pulse into that instead of a low voltage pulse. And the high voltage pulse, you can run this motor with very low amperage. And, you know, it's a maybe a trick, a hack, or whatever people want to call it. I don't know why more industry isn't using it, but the fact of the matter is, I've seen it enough places now to know it works, so I'll be working on duplicating that experiment. I don't really invent things, I just duplicate others' work, you know what I mean?
Well, cool. I'm hoping to, once I get this Twitch platform figured out and can live broadcast video as well as the radio, do a simultaneous show where when I'm talking about something, you can actually see what it is I'm talking about. We do post links here in on the Super Chat, but it sure would be a lot better that if I'm trying to explain something to somebody, I can hold something up in front of the camera and show them exactly what I'm talking about. But all this information...
Absolutely.
All this information we're making available here on ShazizRadio.com, and people come and they add things to the chat room all the time, and Anon9210's talking about helping to bring the Dream Team together, which is, this is how it all works, folks. getting guys like Ted and everybody else to come on here and do shows together and talk about different projects that they're working on or different research that they've came across and such. That's what the Dream Team's all about. So anyway, basically, to sum it all up before we get up out of here, I talked about different, this being a thought experiment to see how far you can take each one of these concepts and put them into action using existing technology that you may be getting ready to throw in the trash. You might want to just hold on to it, you know. You can take something as simple as the concept of dehumidifier, and you can pull water right straight out of the air. Once you understand how that process works, you could have a fresh water source using the temperature difference like what the dehumidifier does. Being able to take energy, which would normally be obnoxious, it's hotter than heck outside during the summertime, and so you go inside and you run your air conditioning, and while that was going on, you make yourself a heat battery, which I explained a simple one that you can actually test out, get you a thick piece of rubber about the size of a Peltier element and a heat sink on the opposite side, and put it out in the sun, and you'll see that it will start to produce a voltage, and then you can actually carry it inside and it'll still keep on producing a voltage until those two temperatures actually change, you know, to be the same temperature or whatever. And the types of materials that may take longer to heat up, take a lot longer to cool back down, and different types of materials that don't take long to heat up and they're really good conductors of heat. So you know how to transfer energy using different types of materials, which is going to raise the efficiency. Talked about storage, the specific heat, which I just mentioned about why, you know, water, specific heat qualities are different than land, is because it takes more energy and longer to heat up that much water, but it takes just as long for that water to be able to cool back down to its normal temperature. So that's raising the efficiency up. And, you know, all these things, Peltier elements, rubber, compressed air, you know, being able to compress air and generate heat, and the type of compressor head that you use, something from like a piston style to the more high-tech oilless ones that have a positive displacement screw type deal where it starts off at wide and it forces that in and keeps pressurizing it smaller, kind of like what they do in turbos in your car. And maybe to the extent of actually taking that type of compressor technology and actually using, instead of a resistive load, a resistive wire for heating, you actually compress the air and heat it up that way. And by recirculating that air and constantly compressing it and releasing it out into a room, could you get compressed air to actually be a more super efficient heating source for your room or even a supplementary heating system? We know that when we compress a gas, it heats up. So what can you do with that? Well, HVAC, if you study a little bit about that, the heat exchange system and how it actually functions, then you might be surprised at what you can actually do. Stephen Gibbons said in chat room, was Ted on about the Easy Motor by Laser Saber, or did he say the AZ Motor? Did you say AZ Motor?
A Alpha. A is an Alpha, number 2, numeral 2, and then letter Z, Zulu.
Cool.
A to Z. And I'll just give me a second here. She says, I'm going to pull over and look up that that guy's site for us real quick, okay?
All right, well, we're getting ready to roll up out of here anyway. You got any last words of wisdom before we peel up out of here?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's important to love each other. I know that.
Well, that's always a plus. Well, folks,
hard with friends and family and people who are around the most is hardest. Strangers on the street is easier, you know, which is kind of ironic, but it's just the way it is.
Yep. Sometimes this world seems to be upside down. Well, folks, we talked about the last thing I forgot to mention on there. Taking your air conditioner that normally uses to cool your house and using the hot side of the gas to actually circulate through a heat exchanger and heat your pool water at the same exact time. If you take that concept and you run with it, you could take your refrigerator, your air conditioner, and you know, your freezer, your deep freezer. Anytime that compressor comes on, it's going to generate hot gas, and that hot gas then in turn can circulate through a system that would exchange that heat into a different medium such as water or whatever, and then be able to store it or use it to supplement your hot water bill that you would have to keep your hot water heater from kicking on as much and making your system more efficient. So I wish we had more time to talk about this today, but got other projects that I need to get to. And so with that said, you've been listening to Mad Science. If you like what you hear here, please share the podcast with everybody. Peace and love, everybody. Take care. Thanks again, Ted.
Yeah, man. Pleasure.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.